This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from the Tantalk Radio Network studio in glorious Clearwater, Florida. The perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. This half hour is sponsored by Larson & Larson. They are intellectual property specialists. So whether you have written a book or a movie script or even come out with a great idea for a patent like I did, then you need Larson & Larson. Protect your valuable intellectual property rights. For a free consultation, call 727-546-0660. They're my lawyers. They should be yours. Well, I'm so excited today because I have a fantastic guest, Margaret George. She is, of course, a New York Times best-selling author, and one of the, I call her the queen of historical novels. I'm so excited to have you on the program today, Margaret. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
I hear you fine.
Good.
Well, this is so exciting. Your writing has been called refined and brilliant, and I just call it delightful.
Well, thank you.
I
love having readers like you.
Well, I've got some wonderful, wonderful listeners who are, I know, so excited that you're on the program today.
Well, I'm eager to talk.
Well, and there's one special listener I'd like you to say hi to. Can you say hi to Mickey for me?
Yes, hello, Mickey. I'm so glad to hear you listening.
Well, she is a great fan of yours, as am I. And, as I was saying, to read your books is, it's such a delightful experience. It's like you lose yourself in history when one reads your books. And we're going to talk about, we can't talk about all of your books, but, of course, at the top of my list is Elizabeth the First, and I want to talk about that, and then we'll touch on the other books. Of course, the story, which I love, the story about her father, Henry the Eighth. So we'll talk about everything, but particularly Elizabeth, because, in this time of life is so strange, and we're looking at our leaders in all the time and wondering, what are they missing? And then you look back at Elizabeth, and it is so moving the way you open this book about Elizabeth, and you open it at such a crucial time in her life. And tell us a little bit about this, what she did that made it so amazing, the trip to Tilbury.
Oh, well, first of all, I will say that because I had written about her childhood in Henry VIII, and her middle years in Mary, Queen of Scots, which was almost a dual novel because, their lives were so intertwined, I wanted to write about the last years of her life in this book because they're not usually covered. I mean, they usually stop at the Armada, but she ruled another 15 years after that. And a lot of things you think of as the Elizabethan age actually didn't happen until those 15 years, like Shakespeare didn't even come to London until after the Armada. So I wanted to start there, but I think that she's a very interesting person because she really was a warrior. She was a warrior queen, and she wanted to go down and see her ships actually out fighting the Spanish. And she was persuaded by her counselors, or actually almost forced, which is something most people didn't do with Elizabeth, to say it just was too dangerous, and they didn't want her to risk her person like that. So they said, how about addressing your land troops instead? And so she decided to do that and go to address the troops at Tilbury, but it was quite a remarkable speech, one of the greatest ones in the English language, and of Shakespearean almost. And, she got herself all, first of all, the wearing white had become, like the sign of the Virgin Queen, but also that she really stood out on her white horse with her white dress and her, and then her breastplate and her helmet, really like some kind of ancient, you know, Athena, and then gave this really stirring talk. Now, you know, we wonder how many people could actually hear this because they didn't, you know, they didn't have our amplification system. But Elizabeth, being a very good public relations person, had handily had copies of it printed and ready to be circulated and handed out afterward for people that couldn't actually hear it. So, you know, that's where the famous one where she says, you know, I may have the weak and feeble body of a woman, but I have the heart and stomach of a king, and of a king of England too, and I think it foul scorn the Duke of Parma would try to invade my realm.
Well,
you know, it's a wonderful, stirring kind of speech. I mean, I'm sure everybody was ready to go out and...
And the way you introduce it, the way you open your book and lead us to that moment, mm-hmm. it's so dramatic. It's so beautiful. It's like one feels one is walking right there beside her. Now, I love, of course, the way that you wrote this book. You used, it's, of course, a novel, but you're writing it as an autobiography. And from two points of view, from Elizabeth's point of view and from her cousin's point of view.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to be able to, you know, that whole thing about the Earl of Essex, some people have spun that into a very, you know, May-December romance and tried to make him into this great romantic hero. And I thought the only way you're going to get to see the Earl of Essex and see his point of view and from the other side is to actually involve, you know, his side of the family. And plus his cousin, you know, his mother, Lettice, is a very interesting woman in her own right. And that just seemed to be the right way to tell the story.
And it works beautifully. The moving back and forth between the story, each of them telling their story and their how they saw things, is just brilliant.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I think, you know, I love the first person. And when I started to write and I did my Henry VIII, I was told that nobody does first person anymore. It's not right. But it didn't seem, I mean, we know what these people did, but we want to know why they did it. And so it just seemed that the first person was a good choice for me. I think people write more easily in one or the other, you know, third or first. But for these kind of people, they said you want to be inside their heads.
It brings an intimacy.
Yeah, yeah. So since then, of course, that's not true anymore that people don't write in the first person. You know, there's so many trends and fads and things that come and go, and the first person is no longer taboo like it was back when I did Henry.
Well, you know, it works perfectly, and of course it suits your style because you bring this, you put the reader right into their shoes and right into their world, and, you know, I sometimes envy a writer, you know, that they've done this or this. But when I was reading, when I read all of your books, but when you know, I feel like, you know, so envious because you have, it's almost like you sort of have transported yourself into a different time. You're part of the whole scene.
Yeah, I'm very lucky that way, and especially I think when it's first written, which is the difference between. You know, when you write it for the first time, it really is, it feels to me like it's just happening, and I'm just the scribe, you know, writing it down. I'm not making it up. I'm really kind of seeing it in front of my eyes, and I'm hearing it. It doesn't seem like I'm just choosing the words and making it up at all. And so it's a real you know, immersive experience for me, which that's my favorite part, of course. I mean, I enjoy doing the research. I enjoy learning. But the most fun is to get as close as you can to being in a time machine.
Well,
what it feels like.
Well, exactly. And that's what it feels like when you know, one reads your books. You know the people so well. It's you have this intimacy with the people that you just can write about them so naturally. It's fantastic talent.
Well, thank you. I have no idea how I do it, actually. I don't know how I do it, but I'm very grateful that I can. And I always wonder, you know, I always wonder what the people themselves would think about it. I mean, that's really who I write for. You know, often they say, well, you know, think of a person that you write for. Think of a lady in Peoria, or think of your great aunt Wilma, or think of this or think of that. But I only think about Elizabeth, and what would she think of it? Or what does Cleopatra think about this? And so that may be partly why it seems, I don't know, like part of them, because that's really who I'm writing to and with and so on.
Elizabeth would enjoy the way that you've written about her. There's an honesty to it, and without some of the floweriness that some people add to it. I mean, you talk about her and write about her as one feels she really would want to be portrayed.
Well, thank you. I hope so. I know she, like a lot of these people, have been the victim of all kinds of things projected off onto them, and I think often Elizabeth is seen, especially in her younger years, as, you know, that there will be lots of things about all of her courtships and flirtations and all that, but I really felt that her, you know, that she was a politician. So it was nice to write about her older years where you didn't have to, she was not playing marriage games with, well, except for the French frog, who I think she was genuinely fond of the frog. And may have come as close to getting married as she ever had with him. And so I did want to have that, and I don't think it was really a ploy on her part, but in the end she just couldn't go through with it.
Well, that's one of the charming stories in the book, and one that, you know, I so hope that people would go beyond, you know, Elizabeth has sort of become a caricature almost.
Yeah.
And that's a shame, because as you said, there was such depth, and particularly at this, in this book, with during this age where she is so political, it really makes you, as I sort of were in this political season, and that's why I thought, well, whoa, there's nobody like this. Nobody, there's not one leader out there today who could, you know, make this kind of speech, so stirring, so brilliant. And, you know, it's amazing. I just love the way you wrote this book.
I wonder if she'd win any primaries today.
Ah, well, that's an idea. I have a feeling she would.
I have a feeling maybe. She was such a consummate politician that whatever the game is that's on today, she could master that one too.
Well, I think so. And of course, you know, I'm from Michigan, from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. I'm a Youper.
Okay.
But one of the things that I think this came from the long winters that we used to have, and I as a child, I read and read and read, and I read everything, and I became really obsessed with England. So that's why I really appreciate your writing about Elizabeth and about her father, because as soon as I had money, as soon as I had saved up enough money, and I was in my early 20s, and I had saved up $25,000, which is like, it was 19,000 pounds in those days, I bought a 400-year-old cottage in an English village.
Oh, really?
Yes, called Sonning-on-Thames, near Henley. And so I bought this cottage because I was so deeply interested in England. And it was very funny. When I bought it, I, of course, hired a contractor to help fix it up. It was run down. And so he said to me, do you want the good news or the bad news? And I said, well, I want the good news. And he says, you've got dry rot. And I thought, well, that's not good to me. And then I said, and that's it? And he said, oh, no, there's more good news. I said, great. And what's that? He said, well, you've got wet rot. I said, okay. And then I said, so what's the bad? I mean, that was the bad news. And what's the good news? I had a 40-foot hole under my front room.
No.
Yes, 40 feet down. He opened up, he lifted up a board, and he said, look down there, and there's a 40-foot hole. And it led to one of those tunnels.
Really?
Yes. So there I had one of the tunnels that, of course, was during Henry VIII's time, underneath, going down to the River Thames, because my house was, St. Anne's Cottage was up on the High Street. And there, underneath my house, was a 40-foot drop into that you could then go to a tunnel. Of course, it cost me another few thousand pounds to fill that tunnel in. Because I didn't want, because of the wet rot and the dry rot, I didn't want, you know, to fall through the floor.
Wow. You know, did anybody go into the tunnel and see if there was anything in it?
Well, they had already in the town. They'd already looked at all of the things. I never was so adventurous. it's 400 years old. I said, I don't think so. But so I was sort of intimately involved with Henry VIII at that point. I just got so obsessed with reading about him. And of course, when your book came out, I love your point of view on Henry VIII. I love, first, that you use this autobiographical method to write about it. And I like that you didn't make him the bad guy.
I know. Well, you know, I felt that he really is, as it says in the book, you know, he was a remarkable person. And, of course, you know, he had this reputation of, you know, Bluebeard and, you know, this really terrible guy. And and all the stories had been told from the point of view of his victims. You know, they were all the Anne Boleyn. And it was about the time of the Man for All Seasons, you know, the saintly Thomas More, who may not have been quite so saintly after all. And I just felt, you know, especially the young Henry, at that time, it was about the time the Six Wives of Henry VIII came on the BBC, the series. People didn't ever know there was a young Henry. That had golden hair and was a great athlete and had all these, you know, these high-minded ideas. And so I felt that I really wanted to bring that side of him out. So Henry wanted it brought out. and I wanted to bring that to the public because scholars knew this, of course. I mean, that's where I got my information from. It was well known, but not in the general public. So I really kind of felt I was doing a reclamation effort, and I do have to say that, my newest book is similar in lots of ways because it's about the Emperor Nero, who also has about like Henry VIII, a lot of bad PR, but there's a lot about him that's known by scholars but not known by the general public. So I'm hoping I can do as good a job with Nero I did with Henry, and that book is actually coming out about a year from now. So I've been very involved in ancient Rome and you know, the golden boy who, you know, what happens to him, but he may not be as lost as people have assumed.
Well, exactly. You know, with Henry, and because I had already done some research before I read your book, because as I said, I became sort of obsessed with Henry VIII at that point when I was living in England, and I was so happy with your story. I just, and of course, again, you have the juxtaposition. You have
Will Summers.
Yeah, Will, giving his point of view of the events at the time, and it's really so interesting.
Yeah, you know, I love the first person, but it can be a little limited. And you would like to know a bigger frame of what's going on in the outside world, a viewpoint about how others viewed him. And then, of course, I needed a character who outlives him so that he can tell what happens afterward, because obviously Henry's not going to narrate his own death. And I was so lucky there was a Will Summers, a real true historical character, you know, who was with him most of his life and did outlive him, and it's even in a painting with him. So he was very close to him, and I was really fortunate because he was kind of tailor-made for being able to help tell that story.
Well, just like in Elizabeth, Lettice lived for another, 30 years after Elizabeth died?
Yeah.
So she was rich material for you to work with.
Yeah, you do want to know, you know, you have these characters. You have Henry VIII, you have Mary Queen of Scots, you have Cleopatra, you've got Nero, you've got Elizabeth. You want to know, well, you know, okay, but what happened afterward? Because you've built up the story, and of course in real life, you know, we die and we don't know what happens afterwards, and we don't describe our own death, but in a book you want to know.
Exactly. Did you do now? When, as of course, you've done so much research for all of these books. Did you do any of your research at the library at the British Museum?
No, I did not. I've been there, and in fact, they actually just 2009. They had a big Henry VIII exhibit there. It was just wonderful. It would have been a great help if they had had it like 20 years earlier. but no, I did not do anything there.
That's a shame. I did a lot of research when I was in England, and those days, as a matter of fact, right there in the British Museum Library. That's before they turned it into a fishbowl. Now they've. You know, that's where Karl Marx used to sit and write.
Yes.
And it was so wonderful in those days because you could call up and they would bring you any book that you wanted. So where did you do most of your research?
Well, you know, I don't do primary research. You know, I don't go into archives. First of all, just back up a little bit, I was actually at the Folger Shakespeare Library a couple of weeks ago, and they're having an exhibit about basically the documentary things relating to Shakespeare, and they had some manuscripts that were left England for the first time, and anyway, I couldn't read a word of them because of the handwriting, so I'm really not qualified to do archival or primary research, so I have to use, you know, what scholars have done the spadework for me, and so mine basically consists of library research, of which, you know, I can actually try to own the books myself. Because that way they're at hand, and I can put little post-it notes in them, and they're there for years afterwards. So if people ask me a question, where did you get this, that, and the other, I try to always note. I print out what I write, and then I always note in the margins, where did you get it from? Because, you know, 6 years later, you're not going to remember page such and such of the, you know, what book, and I keep the book. So I'm kind of a hoarder of books and materials, and I every time I would go to any historic site, of course, I would get tons of.
Yeah, you don't have to tell me about hoarding books.
And all that. Yeah, you said you have how many books?
Well, I stopped counting. You know, I schlepped them from. As I said, I lived in England, and of course, I went endlessly to bookstores over there, buying up secondhand books. That I lived in Iran, then I lived in Israel, then I lived in Texas, and everywhere I go, I. When we moved from Texas, we had to have a U-Haul truck full of my books.
Really?
So,
my goodness.
Can imagine, and of course, your books are being particularly thick.
Yeah, they're heavy to drag around.
Now, is it true? I couldn't believe it when I heard the story that you actually wrote Henry VIII by hand.
Yes, it's true, and you know, I still have it. I guess I will donate the papers.
Oh, you have to. I mean, somebody's going to look at that, and I mean, I thought you're like the modern day Tolstoy.
Well, you know, I wrote them on a yellow pages with a number 2 pencil, and then for earlier books, because I had written other books to try to get them published, but they weren't historical. I could type, and I had taken typing in high school, thank goodness. But then I would have to, you know, type it all out on my, what was at the time, the state-of-the-art, you know, IBM correcting.
The Selectric thing?
Which I loved.
Was it the Selectric?
It was a Selectric, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I love the sound of the Selectric.
Yeah. And so, you know, but I would always write out the stuff by hand first because I never had learned to think on a typewriter. And plus, if you made a mistake back then on a typewriter, it's actually easier to correct a mistake by hand. but halfway through Mary Queen of Scots, I realized I was not going to make my deadline if I kept doing it this way. I was going to have to learn to write on a computer. And it was a really hard transition for me. But I must say, I do not any longer write out. So all of Henry VIII, and half of Mary Queen of Scots were written out by hand. The others were all done on a computer.
Oh, wow, that's fantastic. Look, I have to take a quick commercial break, but when I come back, I want to talk to you. Well, I want to talk to you about food.
Okay.
Okay. We'll be right back.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Are you a writer? Do you have a great idea for a movie? Want to know how to get started? Then join the Actors, Screenwriters, and Crew Production Group. They meet every month in Clearwater to talk about how to construct a winning script, get your script read by the group, or just join in the fun. Contact Barbara Harrington, the best-selling author of Give Him Back to God, for time and location. She brings her experience as a screenwriter and casting director in such hit films as Cocoon and Absence of Malice to this lively group of film enthusiasts. So call Barbara, 727-572-6345, or email her at bharrington2@tampabay.rr.com. Get inspired, and one day you may hear those magic words, lights, camera, action. Call Barbara for details at 727-572-6345.
Hi, I'm John Rakowski with Charles Ruttenberg Realty. Don't you love living here in the Tampa Bay area? Oh, I'm sorry, you don't live here yet? Well, if you already are or thinking about it, call me at my office at 727-538-9200 extension 2 for any real estate needs, including a free market analysis of your home. Your home is worth more than you can imagine. Call me today at 727-538-9200 extension 2. I'm John Rakowski.
Looking for a good book? Whether you want the latest bestseller or a rare book, Haslam's Bookstore at 2025 Central Avenue in downtown St. Petersburg is the place to visit. Haslam's has been in business for over 70 years and is the largest new and used bookstore in Florida. With 30,000 square feet and over 300,000 books, you'll find just the right book for you. Bestsellers, cookbooks, military, history, and so much more. Check out their website, www.haslams.com, to find out about their special events. Remember, Haslam's, one of Florida's true treasures, 2025 Central Avenue in St. Petersburg, and they're open on Sundays from noon to 5.
This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
This is Patsy with a Z, and I'm back with my guest, Margaret George, best-selling author of books such as Elizabeth the First, Helen of Troy, Mary Called Magdalene, and, of course, Henry VIII, and the memoirs of Cleopatra, which was made into a miniseries. Hi, Margaret.
Hi.
Well, one of the things I want to talk to you about is food, because, you know, for a writer, it's always wonderful to know about the food that your characters eat. And I really enjoyed having on your webpage that you have a lovely webpage, and one that I highly recommend readers go to, because it's full of interesting information about your writing and stories about where you went and your travels. And of course, I love the thing about food.
You mean what to serve the book clubs?
What the people like to eat. And I was looking at, of course, in Elizabeth, you write a wonderful chapter there about the Sultan of from Turkey, who sends a gift to Elizabeth. Tell us a little bit about that.
Oh, gee. Remind me.
that was all of that lovely food that he sent, the dry fruits and the... And the wonderful carpet he sent to her, and
well, you know, the kind of foods that they had then. I mean, coming from that part of the world, I already knew a lot about them because of Mary Magdalene and Cleopatra, and now, you know, Nero. They would send their special kind of foods, their honeys and their dried, maybe dried fruits. And their special carpets, I don't know much beyond that to say about them. They had to be preserved, of course, so they could travel a long distance and have to be something that, you know, they might not be able to get in England.
Well, you know, one of the projects I'm working on is a television show program that I'm working on. It's called History, It's Food. And it's sort of teaching history through food. And, of course... I just love to know what famous people in history like to eat. And, of course, we know that Henry VIII loved eels.
Yes, he loved eels.
And Elizabeth loved herring, which is great with me because I love herring myself.
and apparently liked her sugar.
I guess so.
But she didn't eat very much, you know. She was very sparing in her eating. I guess maybe she had a bad example from her father.
Well, that's true. So she learned her lesson.
She would often, you know, have the table set, but would eat very little. And she might often would just eat in her room and then not eat very much. She did drink wine, but never, you know, to excess like other people in the court. And as for what, you know, it's kind of hard in a way. I mean, in like in the Nero book, you know, the Romans and their banquets and their excesses and those strange foods that they are purported to have served, they really kind of stretch your imagination. The flamingo tongues boiled in honey and the you know, the like our turducken, don't we have that thing where it's a duck inside of a turkey inside of a something, and they had all these layers of food that you could cut it open and birds would come out and things like that. I think people are kind of fascinated by the whole Roman Empire banquet stuff, and of course Henry's banquets. They often, you know, will have these Tudor banquets or kind of mainstay holiday time and different fundraising activities. And I've been to a few in England, I'm sure you have too, and they're not really authentic, but you do get that atmosphere about the long table and the costumes. And
well, that's the fun part, to be able to,
you know, all of that.
To be able to wear a costume is always fun.
Yes, always fun.
Yeah, that's in a way that's sort of what my television series that I'm working on and trying to get done is History as Food is including encouraging people to have parties. You know, nowadays so many people are just always on their electronic media and they don't communicate with each other, and so I want to encourage people to not just make the foods that famous people ate, but to have parties and invite your friends over and dress up and just enjoy life, you know, with food and with a little bit of history.
Yeah, well, I always have a publication party for my friends here in where I live, and we do try to do that. And I always say costumes encouraged but not required because, you know, some people don't want to put on a costume, but I've had great success with that, especially with Cleopatra. We had a party where people came in, you know, Egyptian and Roman costumes, and it was just great fun. So I'm planning to do that for Nero.
Oh, that should be fun.
I can manage, though, a dinner on those couches, you know.
Oh, I'd love that. You have to invite me. I want to come to that one.
Yeah, okay. Well, I do have a friend that has a large house who always hosts these parties for me because my house is not that big. And it is a lot of fun. It's a lot of work, but it sure is a lot of fun.
Oh, it is.
It's even got on television one time because it was so colorful. So, I'm gearing up for that one.
Oh, that should be great. Now, of course, you were born to write. I mean, you know, sometimes I have to ask writers like, how did you start writing or when did you start writing? But you were born to write, and it's so funny. That you're like one of the youngest writers to get rejected early on in your career. And tell everybody, how old were you when you got your first rejection letter from a publisher?
My first rejection was when I was about 10.
Oh, wow.
I had written, I had started writing these books when I was about 8, I think, 7 or 8. And of course, they were all handwritten. And they were always, they started out, this was a portent of things to come. They were long. So I had written this book about a horse, because, you know, little girls go through horse phases. And there's a book about a horse. It was 150 handwritten pages long with all of my drawings, you know, my paintings in there. And I had read so many horse books that, of course, I knew all the editors. And, I mean, I knew the publishing houses. I knew the editors. I knew the dedications. I knew the illustrators. And so I told my father I was all finished with my book, and could we send it off, and, you know, and could, because he had to wrap it all up, and send it off to Grosset and Dunlop, because they were publishing a lot of horse stuff then. And I even said, you know, if you don't like my drawings, I would like to have Piers Crowell illustrated, please. So, of course, this came back, but I got a very nice note from the editor. you know, on the back saying, you know, we think you have a budding talent and, you know, please keep writing and then learn to spell. And I've kept that all this time.
What?
Because I think it was a wonderful thing. I don't know if they would do that anymore, especially with all the electronic submissions and things, but it was a wonderful thing for a little girl. And it really made me think that all you had to do, you had to write a good book, and then everything else would take care of itself. And I didn't worry about the process. I just figured, well, okay, next time. And that I think that was a really good and encouraging kind of thing to have happen to me. So I kept on writing. I didn't try to ever submit things until they were all finished. And so I liked a lot of different kinds of writing, really, and but none of the others got published, and then the Henry came about because I was so enthralled with the idea of bringing the real Henry to the world, and you know, I got all so it was almost like a crusade. So that's really how I ended up, you know, as a historical novelist, and I had a combination of what I would say is, you know, a kind of an adolescent. A soaring adolescent imagination, but I was also kind of anal compulsive about facts, and I loved learning facts, and I loved compiling them, and I, you know, putting those two together, kind of, yeah, that's how I ended up writing gigantic historical novels.
And they are gigantic, and but you know, the funny thing is, one reads your books, and at the end you say, I mean, you never realize that they were so long, because it's like they ended too quickly, you know, they're wonderful.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I'm always sad when they're over. Somebody recently asked me, you know, when a book is over, you know, when you write the last thing, do you celebrate and bring out the champagne? And I said, no, I'm actually kind of sad because, you know, I've waited so long to write it and I've enjoyed it and now it's over and I can't ever write about that person again because it's done and it's kind of like a little mourning period.
Well, that's that one gets that feeling, as I said, because when you're writing, your books feel so much like you are in the moment. And I can imagine that feeling of just, whoa, what am I going to do now? You know, it's over.
Well, you feel like that, yeah, you've been on this journey with a person, and then all of a sudden, you know, they get on the train and go away. And you're left on the platform.
Of course, luckily, you have so many characters, so many places you can go. I was thinking as I read Elizabeth, I was thinking, well, one of the characters that you might one day write a book about is Dr. D, astrologist.
Dr. D, you know, he's in there. You know?
Oh, yeah, he's in there.
Yeah.
But he could take up a whole book himself, I think.
That's true. I have a friend, actually, Bob Breyer, who's also an Egyptologist, who apparently knows a lot, has written a lot about Dr. D, may even be related to him. Oh, you know, one thing I meant to tell you, and we got onto another subject, and it's sort of like your cottage, is that in between books, and I had a nice resting time, I, you know, really began to pursue some genealogy, and I found, to my surprise, I actually had an ancestor that was in Elizabeth's court, William Aubrey, who was one of her lawyers and was on one of her, you know, committees to see about Mary Queen of Scots, and would she recant, and would she sign a paper, and she called him my little lawyer, and he was buried in St. Paul's. Now, if I had known that when I wrote the book, I would have been sure to have a scene of him in there, but I thought, well, it kind of, maybe there's some kind of thing where, in a way, I was in the court, or I had a connection I didn't even know about, so those are always exciting things to...
Well, it could well be, and if we could bring back Dr. D, he would probably say that you were there.
Yeah, he probably would, but no, he's quite a character.
He is, and I was thinking that would make a wonderful book. You know, of course, you're working on Nero, and I just want to touch briefly, did you enjoy the process of Cleopatra being turned into a miniseries?
I did, very much. I was very lucky. They asked me if I would be okay talking to the screenwriter they had assigned to turn it into a screenplay in case he had some questions. And I said, sure. And it turned out he's actually a novelist, quite a very respected novelist, Stephen Harrigan, who has a new book out now called A Friend of Mr. Lincoln.
I just spoke to him on Tuesday. He was on my program on Tuesday.
We became great friends through this, and he taught me so much about about, you know, how you do a screenplay and why he was making these choices and everything. And together, you know, we watched, we went and stayed with him in Texas, and we watched the first run of the thing. And he's the one who said, you know, if you want to go to the set, ask them. And I said, oh, can I do that? He said, yeah, call them up and ask them. So he said he didn't want to go because he'd gone to too many of them. But it was more old hat for him. But I went to Morocco. I got to see the filming. The director and the people couldn't have been nicer to me. He said, just make sure you let them know you're not going to make any trouble. They're always afraid of writers coming on the set and saying, you're ruining my book. I said, no, I won't. But no, it was for me, it was a wonderful experience.
That's so fascinating. That I just had him on the program on Tuesday.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Hey.
And I was talking about his new book and a friend of Mr. Lincoln, which I really like, and I was so enjoyed talking to him. And wow, this is amazing.
That's a funny connection.
It is.
That was because of him. I had such a wonderful time with it. But he's such a talented man. And does so many things, and so I'm really, impressed by him. But yeah, I had a great time. But well, he was my mentor for all that.
You know, as I was saying, you have a very nice web page, and one of the things, of course, on the web page, you have some of your adventures of where you've photos of where you traveled in England to look at some of your mm-hmm. things and some of the sites, of course. Most of them I've seen, and myself, and I think it. Anybody who reads your books, both the Henry VIII and the Elizabeth, should read them and then take a trip to England, because it is fun to go to many of these locations. They're not all there anymore, but so many are, and to be able to walk in their footsteps.
Yeah, you know, there's been kind of a trend of actually having authors lead people on tours, to the places, the sites where their characters lived. And I was actually, there's a group called Academics Abroad, and they wanted me to do a tour, a Tudor tour, but I couldn't get enough people. And Alison Weir has been very successful in doing that. She has quite a thing going with a lot of tours, but, you know, she lives in England. And to her and her people, it's not a jump over the pond. And I think the cost and everything made it not so attractive to Americans. I'd love to do a Cleopatra tour or a Nero tour, but again, that part or Helen of Troy tour. But again, I think unless you actually live there and the people that would be going on it, can get on a train and get there easily, it becomes much more of a daunting kind of experience. But yeah, I put those things up hoping people will go to those places.
Yeah, exactly. And they should go to your website, and they can look at all of these things. And, of course, they can read more about you. It's so fascinating. I love that photo on your website of you as a child in front of the pyramids.
Yeah, I do, too. You know, my father took me to Egypt when I was 9 because I was so enthralled with all this ancient history stuff. And he took me there. And my sister later said, why was he wearing a coat and tie in the desert? And the thing is, of course, people always wore coats and ties back then, even if they're on a camel in the desert.
Exactly. And it's a beautiful, beautiful photo. Of course, I think this is probably where you started getting your deep interest in history. You traveled a lot as a child.
Yeah. Well, my father took that picture of me in front of that statue. And I remember him saying, if you ever write your book about Cleopatra, you need to have this photo, in there. I guess he just felt it was very captured. He wanted to call it Modern Girl Meets Ancient Egypt, but I don't think I'm all that modern, really. I sometimes don't feel like a very modern person. I say I'm really more Victorian than I am, modern.
Well, if you keep digging in your family ancestry, we're going to find out you have a connection to Cleopatra.
I would love to find that out. I once tried to figure out it would it even be possible, and I made up this long story about how, to myself, I knew it was a fiction, you know, that, well, you know, she had these children, they went back to Rome, maybe one of them became a soldier, and he went up to England, and he married a local person, and because all my ancestry is English. And I said, so that's how I'm descended from Cleopatra, showing that if you're an eager, you know, fictionalizing things, you can think of all kinds of stuff.
Well, I think, as a child, when we have vivid imaginations, well, like you and like I did, you know, for some reason, I'm born in the Upper Peninsula, and I'm a Youper, and I have absolutely no connection to England and no English relatives. And yet, as I said, I always had this feeling that I belonged in England and that I had to have a house in England, which was very strange. I mean, there's absolutely no reason for it. But I think at one point in my childhood, I thought I was really abducted and I was really a princess and I belonged in England. So it's so funny that, what we think of when we're children.
Well, we have these kind of psychic or mystic connections to certain places. I do think that's true. Do you still have the house?
No, unfortunately. I mean, I had it for many, many years, and unfortunately I sold it, and I'm now so sorry I did, because eventually I got married. As I said, I moved around a lot. We landed up in Texas for many years, and then we came to Florida, and I sold it because I wasn't back there at all. But I wish I had not sold it there, because it is still there. It's 400, well, you know, it's coming up to, let's see, Elizabeth died about over 400 years ago, and my house was made of one long ship, the mast from a ship.
Really?
Yes, and it ran through, it goes through several, they were connected cottages, and it's still there. It's St. Anne's Cottage on the High Street, and it was just a wonderful thing to live there, and I did feel sort of a mystical connection to something, somebody in England. So it's strange.
Yeah. Well, it's very hard though to keep a place empty and kind of manage it from far away.
Yeah.
And you were really pretty far away.
Too far away, but. Thinking back on it, I wish I still had it, because I have it at least in my mind all the time, because it was a lovely place. Now, I just want to, thank you so much for joining me today. And I know that you're in the middle of, have you finished Nero? Is it in editing yet?
It's being edited. In fact, as we speak, it's going to go off on Sunday night to my editor, and then it will go on to the copy editor. So I'm just putting some finishing touches on it.
Yeah, that is a process.
Yeah, it is. But it's been very gratifying to see it, you know, coming to light, and it will soon be seen by other people. So it's supposed to get published about next year. Late February, early March.
Well, I'm looking forward to reading it. And again, I want to encourage everyone, they can go to your webpage. It's margaretgeorge.com. That's real easy. And you can find the list of Margaret's books. All of them are fantastic, including your children's book.
Thank you. You know, I'll just say real quickly, that really was a true story, because it's about our pet tortoise here in Madison. And a friend who's a veterinarian, also his tortoises. No, it's a true story. It's for children, small children. We had a great fun writing it, and it was so short compared to my other one.
Yeah,
only 3,000 words. That's a big difference. Well, be sure to send me your address so I can get an early copy of the Nero to you.
Oh, that I will. And I want to just tell everybody that you've been collecting tortoises since you were a little girl.
Yes, I have. I have, and my dear old tortoise is still, you know, we've had him now for 33 years.
Oh, wow.
One we have now. And so
you never know what you're going to do when you start as a child collecting tortoises, what it's going to lead to. It's going to lead to a lovely little book that you wrote. So it's available, of course. All of your books are available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, but I do recommend to listeners to go to Margaret's webpage, because it's fun. It's just a fun read, and to look at all the pictures of when she was a child and of her adventures in England. So, Margaret, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
I know all of my listeners are going to be so thrilled to be able to say they listened to you today.
Hey, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Margaret. Bye now.
Bye.
Oh, wow, that's fantastic. It's so thrilling. You know, I've been doing this program almost a year, and I've gotten to speak to so many authors that I just adore. But Margaret is right there on the top of my list because, as I said, I have this connection with England that I love, and I love her books, and I highly recommend them to all of you. Now, next week, I've got some really exciting people coming up. First of all, I have Angela Hunt, who's going to be on next Thursday. Angela is the author who has novelized the new hit movie Risen. It's based on a story by Paul Aiello and a screenplay by Paul Aiello and Kevin Reynolds. And they asked Margaret, who has a degree in divinity, she's a doctor of divinity, to write the novel version of it. And it's a fascinating book, and fascinating, of course, the movie is a really hit movie. It opened on the 19th, and if you haven't seen it, you have to go see it. But join me next week to listen to Angela, and we'll talk to her about not just that, but also about her wonderful novel, The Note, which was featured in a Christmas movie, of course, on the Hallmark Channel. And you will really enjoy listening to her talk about all of the books that she's written. And then on Tuesday, I have the dream guest for every writer. It's Jane Friedman. Jane Friedman has 20 years of experience in the publishing industry, and we're going to pick her brain on how to write a query letter, what you need to do to find an agent, and all sorts of wonderful publishing information, because she was there's nothing that she doesn't know about the publishing world. As an author of a book about publishing, she can answer a lot of your questions. So if you have questions, send them to me at patsy.radio@gmail.com. That's my name is spelled P-A-T-Z-I, in case you don't remember it. Patsy, with a Z, patsy.radio@gmail.com. And give me your questions for Jane, because Jane can answer all of your questions about query letters and everything else you need to know about how to get published. So join me next week for that. And then meanwhile, think about going this weekend to the Miami Avenue Wine Bar in Indian Rocks Beach. It's a wonderful place to spend your Friday and Saturday night listening to live music and dancing and just having fun with friends. They have excellent wines, and you'll really enjoy it. And then all you have to do is remember to have a great weekend, because this is Patsy with a Z wishing you a wonderful, wonderful weekend. Remember, one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken on stage or screen. Join me next Tuesday at 11 a.m. for Joy on Paper. Treasure it and share it, and have a great week.